Hello, my name is Jonathan Kemp, and this talk, which lasts about 12 minutes, aims to give a flavour of using astro or celestial navigation in practice. Finding your position at sea using astro navigation without satellite or electronic systems is an awesome and deeply satisfying experience. It is both a science and an art. This talk records the use of this navigation system in the early 1980s. It is based on my experience as the navigating officer of HMS Apollo in the South Atlantic around the Falkland Islands and South Georgia in 1983-84. HMS Apollo, a Leander-class frigate, had recently been fitted with her first satellite system. It was a chunky box set above the chart table and connected to an aerial on the bridge roof. However, within hours of departing from UK waters, some rough weather led to seawater ingress into the aerial, which meant the system could no longer acquire satellites. This meant that AstroNav was the primary source of our position fixing during the 3-week passage to the Falkland Islands. Although a replacement satellite aerial was received and fitted once we arrived in the South Atlantic, that early satellite navigation system was of limited use during our deployment in southern latitudes. Such was the positioning of the satellites, there was often up to 4 hours between fixes. Also, we were using British Admiralty charts, which in places round South Georgia had last been surveyed by HMS Beagle on the voyage before Darwin had embarked. The age of the chart surveys meant that they were not on the WGS-84 grid, and there was often well over a mile between a position defined by latitude and longitude on the chart and the same position given by the satellite navigation system. While technology has advanced, and current-day satellite-based radio navigation systems such as GPS work well in all areas of the world, it is still dependent on satellites, and in our uncertain world, it does not take much imagination to envisage a situation where satellite availability or accuracy is compromised. I learnt the basics and theory of astro-navigation at Britannia Royal Naval College, Dartmouth, in 1976, and put it into practice in various ships. I obtained my ocean navigation certificate based on a voyage from Hong Kong to Manila and back in HMS Wasperton. My training involved using the Nautical Almanac, together with sight reduction tables and the Royal Navy sight form, to calculate the difference between the altitude of a heavenly body at the assumed or dead reckoning position of the ship and the altitude of that heavenly body above the horizon as actually observed through a sextant. That enabled a position line to be plotted on a special plotting chart using the Mark St. Hilaire intercept method. It would be good going to get a fix from 4 stars onto the chart within 25 minutes of taking the first sight. It requires a fair amount of mental arithmetic and focus. When ships were on passage together, the navigation officer of the senior ship would usually invite the other ships in company to signal the observed position obtained from morning stars and evening stars, and there would be friendly competition in trying to obtain the best result. On an ocean passage, I would plan my day for the possibility of taking 5 sets of sights. These would start with morning stars, when I would be on deck before first light to identify the stars that would be used for those sights, and then wait for the horizon to become visible, so that the vertical angle between the horizon and the star could be measured with the sextant. Mid-morning, I'd take a sun sight, which would give us a single position line. This would be run forward by dead reckoning to combine with a meridian passage latitude at noon, local time, and a further sun sight in the afternoon. Then evening stars when, Again, both the stars and the horizon would be visible. Of course, frequently, a particular planned site could not be taken because of cloud or poor horizon. In these situations, resort could sometimes be made to taking a daytime sight of the Moon or even Venus, which is sometimes visible during daylight hours, due to their relative closeness and difficulty in predicting wobbles. The planets generally made for less accurate sights than stars, the Moon less accurate than the planets. It was important that the navigator was able to take sights without interruption. This meant ensuring that others were performing the duties of officer of the watch and lookout. It would be the same on a yacht today, where, unless you were sailing single-handed, you need to have somebody else to take the helm and to look out while the sights are being taken, the calculations are made, and the position lines plotted. The process for morning stars started the night before. I would work out the time of nautical twilight for the following morning and of sunrise for our estimated position. Nautical twilight starts when the sun is 12 degrees below the horizon, the time at which the horizon first becomes visible and when you can start taking sights. I would arrange a shake so I was awake and able to collect my sextant, deck watch, and position myself on the bridge wing to let my eyes accustom themselves to night vision. The evening before, I would also select the stars that I would aim to take sights on. This was done using a star globe, a beautifully crafted globe set in a mahogany box so that it could rotate and be set up to reflect the horizon at the assumed position of the ship, with the observer assumed to be at the centre of the globe. This enabled a small number of the brightest stars in the sky to be identified, hopefully around 90 degrees apart horizontally, and ideally between about 30 and 60 degrees of elevation. Using the star globe, I would make a list of likely candidates and quickly measure their rough bearing or azimuth and altitude at the time of nautical twilight. Before the horizon became visible, I would set up my sextant by doing the usual error checks and look for at least one of the stars by setting my sextant to the altitude worked out from the star globe and looking down the appropriate bearing. Because the star would have been one of the brightest in the sky, it was surprising how easy it was to identify using this method. In other words, you didn't have to have an encyclopedic knowledge of all the stars in the heavens, although a general understanding of their pattern and their names was helpful. As lights dawned, the ship's dead reckoning position would be noted from the chart, and that would be used as the assumed position for the purposes of plotting the intercepts. The sights would then be taken. Being on board a ship with a sizeable crew, I would have my navigator's yeoman, who was an experienced able seaman and whose main job was to keep our chart outfit up to date with notices to mariners, by my side with the deck watch and notebook to record the sights. As soon as sufficient sights had been taken, I would retire to the chart house, open the sight form book, nautical almanac and sight reduction tables, and calculate the intercepts for plotting. Once plotted, the observed position or obs pos would be marked on the plotting sheet and then on the chart in use on the bridge, and the captain would be informed. Qualified navigation officers were issued with a new sextant, which had been tested at the National Physical Laboratory in Teddington. Navigators treated their sextants with immense care, and after prolonged use, they would get a feel for their own personal error on that particular sextant. The solution of the spherical triangle, often known as the PZX triangle, is for many people the most challenging bit of being able to obtain a position line which can be marked on the chart. Over the years, various methods have been devised to simplify the process of that calculation. Some of these can be seen in the National Maritime Museum in Greenwich. Each method has reflected improvements in efficiency of calculation. I learnt the long way of computing sites, using both the site reduction tables for marine navigation and the rapid site reduction tables for air navigation. But I never needed, or indeed was trained, to use logs, haversines and Norrie's nautical tables. In 1980, I wrote a program for my programmable calculator which replaced the need for using the site reduction tables. The greatest challenge in doing this was restricting the program to 256 steps, which was the available capacity of the calculator. I also designed an updated and shortened form of the version of the site form. Of course, the ephemeris data still came from the Nautical Almanac. This reduced the time taken to produce an observed position from morning or evening stars from the best part of 30 minutes down to 10 or 15 minutes. I felt this was a simple means of using reliable technology to make astronavigation less onerous. I used it regularly and made a presentation on it to the Royal Naval's navigation faculty. Whilst I suspect this was already being put through naval procurement, a year or two later the Navy introduced a similar system using a Hewlett-Packard 41CV calculator with a plug-in memory unit that stored the ephemeris data and also a short version of the site form for recording the essential data by hand. This just demonstrates that there is no one way of calculating sites. You need to find a way that works for you, then practice it and gain proficiency. Like all skills, proficiency in astronavigation requires practice. You need a good routine on board where you can free yourself from the other things going on and focus on the taking of sights, the calculations and the plotting. You also need a tried and tested routine for the actual calculations. Maybe by starting with using the sextant to measure distance off a lighthouse and then moving on to sun sights, perhaps doing a number of sun-run suns or sun-meridian passage, and gaining speed and confidence before then going on to stars, planets and the moon. I hope this recollection may be of some encouragement to anyone thinking of exploring the wonders of navigating by the stars. It is an exploration that you will never forget.